This morning I want to talk about yoga. Yoga is associated with the religion of Hinduism. If we think of Hinduism as a philosophy, then yoga is its practice. The word yoga has the same root in the Sanskrit as the word yoke, and carries connotations of both uniting, yoking together, and of placing under discipline. Take my yoke upon you. In short, yoga is a method of training promising spiritual growth, indeed, ultimately spiritual enlightenment. And that is understood as basically integration, reconciliation, and union with life completely. No more insecure. Well, am I doing the right thing? Am I in the right place? Should I? None of that. The aim of life, wrote the Unitarian Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., is to get as far as possible from imperfection. This is what the transcendentalists Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller and William Ellery Channing meant by self-culture, the continual effort to improve oneself, to grow. And from Emerson and Channing and Fuller on through today, our movement has always affirmed this idea, the great value of evolving and growing spiritually, ethically, psycho-emotionally. Indeed, it's what most Unitarian Universalists think religion should be all about. And on this, the Hindus agree. In fact, they go even further. Hindus believe that overcoming human limitations is the one and only goal of life. And, moreover, they believe that it's possible to transcend human limitations completely to become enlightened. Hindu anthropology, their understanding of the human nature and what's psychic nature, that anthropology maintains that underlying human personality and animating it is a reservoir of being that never dies and is never exhausted. They believe also that if one goes deep enough into their heart of hearts in meditation, that heart of hearts is known as the Atman, what's discovered in this Atman is none other than Brahman, the great creator of the universe, God himself, that responsive reading we read, the consciousness that pervades the beginning and Alpha, Omega, you what? That Brahman, but in fact, the Atman in your deepest, tiny heart of hearts, that is also Brahman. Now, Westerners sometimes find these ideas astonishing, but they're not all that different from some Western ideas. Most of us are familiar in a general sort of way with the theories of Sigmund Freud. Writing about 120 years ago, Freud was the first Western scientifically trained physician to propose the idea of unconscious motivation, that people's behavior is often determined by repressed and unconscious factors buried deeply within their psyche. As Freud understood it, the human mind is two-tiered. One's conscious, intellectual, analytical, trying to psych out reality and figure how to survive. The conscious mind, but underneath that, one's unconscious mind. Now, Carl Jung, an early disciple of Freud's, theorized a three-tiered model of the mind. Like Freud, his earlier mentor, Jung believed that beneath the ego was the personal unconscious. But he also believed that beneath the personal unconscious lay the collective unconscious. According to Jung, individual personalities are all like islands, essentially, all connected under the sea. We're interconnected so extensively, held Jung, that we can never extract ourselves. Indeed, the universe and the psyche, according to Jung, are actually two sides of the same coin. One viewed from within, and one from outside. It's kind of like reality is a cosmic four or five, who knows how many dimensional Mobius strip running up and down your and everyone's spinal column. Can you think that? It's hard because it collapses in categories that we can't usually think without. Psyche and universe are one, inextricably reflected of each other. Atman equaling Brahman. But my point here is this. Here we have, I'm demonstrating two languages, one Western and empirical, the other Eastern and mystical, both describing humanity's intimate internal connection to the forces that create and uphold life. Right here, right now. Hindu literature is replete with images depicting this state of affairs. That we're all like lions, separated at birth from our pride and raised by sheep. Until now we bleat and graze like little lambs, unaware that we are rightfully kings and queens of all the beasts. Or we're like heartbroken lovers, searching the world over for our lost companion, unaware that all along she, he, they have been right next to us. My favorite such image is the Sufi Islamic myth of the mad king, wherein a young prince is called to his father's court one day and sent on an important mission. Go to Egypt, he's told, and mingle with the people and wait for further instructions. Well, so he immediately leaves, as he was told, and some weeks later arrives in that ancient land and proceeds to do as he was told. He learns the language, acquires a skill, quickly blends in quite inobtrusively. He takes a wife, has a family in time. All is going along beautifully until one day a messenger arrives with a message from the man's nearly forgotten, faraway dad. Startled and confused, the prince dismisses the man. That night, however, he has a dream reminding him of his earlier life and mission. He wakes up and has the messenger sent for. Alas, the moment is gone. He cannot be found. All that remains is an enigmatic note to the prince. Your heart knows the way. Follow it home. We are all in this predicament, according to Hinduism. However, despite all of us being in the same existential situation, each individual's way out of that and into freedom and reconciliation, each of us has a unique way to do that. It is our way alone. Unlike fundamentalist Christians who maintain that there is only one way to God, the fundamentalist way, Hindus believe that everyone's path to spiritual awareness is unique and completely their own. The religious scholar Houston Smith, recently died about 3 years ago at 98, I think, points out that while all religions recognize different spiritual personality types, Hinduism is exceptional in the attention it has given to this matter. It identifies four principal types and delineates the programs that are suited to each type. And I'll go over them. We are all unique, says Hinduism. Unique, though everyone may be, however, we are all psychologically constellated in one of only four ways. We're either reflective, emotional, energetic, or what Houston Smith calls experimental, but I would call trippy, enchanted with inner states and not infrequently altered states. These types aren't rigid, by the way. Indeed, everyone's a kind of a mix of all, but nevertheless, everyone's constellated primarily as one type or another, and Hinduism prescribes a distinct yoga for each type. I want to go off on a short tangent. I'll come back to the four yogas shortly, but I want to focus for a moment on our tradition, Unitarian Universalism, and about the growing embrace we have made of pluralism over the last 25 years. Hinduism does a good job of accepting all kinds of people, but this wasn't always quite quite true among Unitarian Universalists. I think especially of the 60s and 70s, when all too often a kind of fundamentalism of the left prevailed in some congregations. If you weren't a certain kind of person, you might not feel all that welcome. In our large congregations, the operative theology tended to be the minister's theology, which admittedly sometimes not all that clearly articulated to begin with. Meanwhile, too many of our fellowships came off as cleansed of all mystery, left-wing, left-lobed debating clubs. Heaven help somebody who walked in anxious about an impending pink slip, an uncertain diagnosis, or a period that's a week late. Not all congregations were equally rigid about such things, of course, and there have always been open and welcoming people among us, people like Dorothy Hopper, who know how to warmly receive guests and make them feel at home. As one of the people in yesterday's circle that I attended said, the warm window of welcome. I felt the warm window of welcome. Well, we can all imagine, we know what that feels like. What changed things so that we decided to be more welcoming, or wished to be? What was it that made our congregations more open to pagans and neo-transcendentalists and other very right-lobed people? I believe it was, at least critical to it, was the adoption in 1985 of our current UUA Purposes and Principles Covenant. On most Sundays, we have these printed in the Sunday bulletin on the back. The third principle of which is acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. People talk a lot about the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of everyone, and the seventh principle, the interconnected web. But it's the third principle, and only the third principle, that distinguishes our faith as a religious organization. The other six, though laudable in every way, could just as easily be guiding principles for the Rotary. My point is, things have changed. Unitarian Universalist congregations are far more pluralistic than they used to be 25 or 30 years ago, and more explicitly spiritual. Perhaps it's attributable to the adoption of the purposes and principles, but whatever the cause, I got to tell you, nowadays UUs everywhere welcome more kinds of people than we once did, which is a good thing, I'm convinced. And our ministers are asked to reach out to more kinds of people using various languages of faith, not just humanism, but a kind of UU Christianity, human potential movement stuff. Freud, Jung, all that. There's a lot of languages that we're invited to know, and it's good if you can. Using various languages of faith, as I have done today by coming out of world religions, or at least that I'm trying to do. And I'm doing all of this because Hinduism, it seems to me, has something very important to teach us when it comes to welcoming a diverse community that's reflective of our changingly and increasingly diverse neighborhood. Now back to yoga. Unitarian Universalists may welcome more diverse types of people than we once did, but still, the largest number of Unitarians, I think, are essentially reflective. In the language of Hinduism, such people are nana yogis, folks whose path to enlightenment, whose spiritual faith trajectory, such as it is through the rational mind. That is to understanding, getting it in their heads. So, not everybody's like that, but some people are. Essentially, Jnana Yoga has three stages. Insight, meditation, morality. Insight into the infinite mind of wisdom and clarity that lies beneath one's ego-driven anxieties and neuroses. Meditation, reflection and contemplation, wherein one visits that deeper mind again and again until it becomes the mind she or he lives in and identifies with. And finally, morality, whereby one brings this deeper expanded sense of identity and connection out in the way they live their life and in exemplification of the inner truths they've come to understand and integrate. It's all about coming to identify with the supreme identity, with the Atman that is Brahman, instead of with one's ego, and then coming out of that supreme identity more and more and more naturally. In his autobiography, Alan Watts refers to Joseph Campbell, the power myth guy, as a Jnana Yogi. Campbell, writes Watts, is an example, although such examples are very rare, of the fact that one can understand certain deep matters of the spirit simply by understanding them. To see it intellectually is to see it all the way through. And while such profound understanding may be true of Joseph Campbell or Alan Watts, who between them wrote about 45 books, most people, I'm quite sure, are less intellectual and reflective than the two of them. I know I am. I know how to think, and I'm very thankful that I do, and it's not an automatic, you have to be taught. But according to the Myers-Briggs Personality Inventory Exam, which is a kind of a Jungian thing, I'm more of a feeling type than a thinking type. And so I strongly suspect are most people, which is why in India, most Hindus follow bhakti yoga, the path to enlightenment through love. The aim of bhakti is to direct toward God the love that lies in one's heart of hearts. One key difference between Jnana and bhakti yoga is that bhakti strives not to identify with the Atman, Brahman inside, not to identify with God, but to simply adore God. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Thus, it's more devotional than conceptual. Hinduism has thousands of gods and goddesses, a cornucopia of spiritual images. And this led many early scholars to presume that Hinduism was pantheistic, when in fact, many spirits are understood by the Hindus to be but multiple faces of the one life behind all life. In its practice, bhakti invites its devotees to immerse themselves in Hinduism's many rituals and ceremonies, and to think of its many images as springboards to deeper understanding. Bhaktas, that is, practitioners of bhakti, are encouraged to recite mantras, kind of repetitive prayer, and to meditate on ishtas, saints, who represent one's chosen ideal. I suspect that a lot of social activists are essentially bhakti yogas, that their response to injustice is primarily and initially and fundamentally an emotional response. It's not the latest statistics of the U.S. Department of Labor that inform most activist politics. It is far simpler than that. Bhakti's hearts hurt when they see people suffering or animals or any part of the world and they feel called to help alleviate it. Period. Karma yoga is a third kind of yoga. The path to enlightenment through work. Our culture here in America is so focused on work that I suspect a lot of us are karma yogis or strive to be. It's not true elsewhere, but in the United States, the second question people ask of one another after inquiring the other's name is, by which they mean, what work do you do or did you do? This is understandable, I guess, after all. Work is life's staple. We must work to survive. But that's hardly the whole of it. For indeed, most people find work satisfying and important to their sense of value and meaning in life. And for such people, Hinduism says you don't have to retire to a cloister to realize the inner divine. Enlightenment can be found in everyday affairs as readily as anywhere. But to do so, one needs to find work that carries them toward God, not away. This is connected to the idea of right livelihood, the recognition that some occupations are more conducive to spiritual growth than others. You can't be an armaments manufacturer if you want to become enlightened, say the Hindus, or a drug dealer, and there are other bad karma gigs. But while you can't be an armaments manufacturer, you can be a warrior. Indeed, the Sumerai tradition and the Arthurian tradition are both about exactly that, finding one's way with honor and integrity as a warrior. Many Unitarian Universalists self-identify as artists. There are artists among our membership here. Most artists are karma yogis, by which I mean doers, people of action. Such women and men are kinetic and energetic, constantly engaged and moving from one thing onto the next. Like my brother-in-law, Bob. Oh, he never slows down. You get up to use the facility and come back and he's already taken the paper and put it in the garbage and saw it at the street. He never slows down. He's constantly moving and busy with some project. I love the guy. It's just the way he is. Now, board presidents that I've known are often like that. Always active. Healthy churches have some reflective types, for sure, but they also have some active types to make sure that the nuts and bolts get attended to, as well as the philosophical concerns. Energetic souls like my brother-in-law Bob are good to have around, writes the late UC religious scholar Houston Smith, but they have to be careful because according to Hindu doctrine, wrote Smith, every action directed toward the external world reacts on the actor. Everything I do for my private benefit adds another layer to my ego. Everything I do just for me, no matter what, it makes my ego thicker. And this thickening separates me from the divine more than I was at the beginning. Conversely, every act that's done without thought for myself diminishes my self-centeredness until nothing separates me from the divine. Thus, karma yogis focus on ways, paradoxically, to make their egos skilled at diminishing their egos. For example, being controlling is egocentric and contrary to the spirit of enlightenment, but using one's controlling impulses to create films or music or art that enables others to let go of control and grow in faith, such that the total equation burns off more karma than it creates, this is a good thing. Back-to-back Oscar winner for Best Director, Alejandro González Iñárritu, said as much in his two acceptance speeches, thanking his creative team of colleagues for their collective support of what was essentially for all of them, but clearly for Iñárritu, a spiritual effort. Karma yoga. Lastly, there's Raja yoga. And that's what we were looking at, the pictures up there. It's the kind of yoga that most of us think about. Practicing leotard and tights, sitting in the lotus position, cross-legged on the floor. Raja hypothesizes four levels of the human self. One's body, one's conscious mind, or one's body, one's conscious mind, one's individual unconscious, and beneath it, being itself, the Atman that is simultaneously Brahman. The Raja Yogi, Joyce, struggles to concentrate her mind, her ever-distractible mind, all of us have that, the monkey mind, and they learn how to sit barely moving for long stretches of time, how to breathe in one nostril and out the other, and how to faithfully perform many other exercises, all designed to activate the mystical Kundalini serpent lying coiled at the bottom of one's spine, who in turn goes up the spine, opens up all the seven chakras, and ushers in enlightenment. Mystical anatomy. Okay, in conclusion, despite what some of our congregations looked like in the 60s and 70s, no healthy group is composed of people who are all alike, or dominated by those who insist on words that, or dominated by those who insist that newcomers behave just as they once did. Many clubs work like that. And clubs can be good places for golf or tennis or sailing or playing cards, but not for the practice of religion. To practice religion, we need communities, beloved communities, to use the term first coined by Harvard philosopher and Western Mountain native Josiah Royce. Beloved communities, later picked up by Martin Luther King Jr., wherein everyone is honored for their unique gifts, iconoclastic as some of those may at first glance appear to be. Just as no healthy beloved community is composed of all similar people, no individual is solely reflective or emotional, activist or experimental. Moreover, different life situations call on different resources to be brought into play. Most of us naturally will find that we make better time on one path than on the others, and so we will keep close to it. Hinduism, however, encourages people to test all four yogas and combine them in ways they find the most productive. Our Unitarian Universalist churches must do the same. This is my prayer. It seems to me we need to find ways to welcome, as it says in our third UU principle, and to accept all kinds of people on their spiritual quests, and to offer one another a variety of ways to nurture spiritual growth among us, if we are to be truly welcoming and beloved as a community. Then we not only have to welcome different types of people, we have to offer them practices that support and encourage their quests, which we are doing more and more, better and better. So let's keep it up. So may it be. Amen. And the Hindu word, namaste.